Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.
So, we're just going to get right into our talk. So, when addressing the so what factor about the title of our talk, which the title is Lessons About Training Black Clergy in Mental Health, What Do We Know? One could ask oneself, why is that even important? Why even talk about mental health training for clergy in general and African-American clergy in particular? So, as far as the problem statement, the literature, those of us who are familiar with this literature know that it consistently shows that African-Americans are underrepresented in traditional mental health treatment. For example, the National Survey of American Life found that only 10% of all black respondents use some form of mental health services within a given year. And that particular study showed that of those, only one-third of those meeting DSM criteria for some type of disorder use formal health services. And we know also from the literature that when given a choice, African Americans turn to informal counseling support, such as clergy, more often than they turn to traditional counseling. The National Comorbidity Survey found that clergy were contacted for help about one-fourth of the time, or 25% of the time, which was more often than primary care physicians. It was also more often than psychiatrists, which were only contacted one-sixth of the time. So people choose clergy for a number of reasons. It's because they're more familiar with clergy. It's because clergy don't charge fees. It's because fewer stigmas are involved with going to a clergy person for help. Clergy, we know that they've been dealing with emotional problems for decades. There's a quote from Religion and the Lives of African Americans that's by Taylor Chatters of Levin, and it states that African American ministers are an important and vital resource for individuals in the African American community. Clergy have played an important role in spearheading the provision of services to their congregations. In spite of this, though, there's little empirical knowledge about a number of questions. So these questions come up. So first of all, what do black pastors believe that their mental health training needs are? Do they even feel that they have mental health training needs at all? Secondly, how do we reach black pastors with a training that's not only effective but also that resonates with their types of ways or their desired ways of learning? And third, what are the best ways for mental health practitioners to collaborate with black clergy? So these are some of the questions that we would like to address and answer. Dr. Dye?
So I'm going to just talk a little bit about the significance. When researching, when you're trying to look at research that is related to training clergy in mental health issues, you want to understand a couple of things. One of them is that according to resulting recommendations that are increasing cultural competence in regards to how to approach African American clergy in relation to mental health training. Now, in this training today, we're using African American and black interchangeably. And also, it promotes a culturally competent, stronger connection to our social work ethics in regards to cultural competence and social justice. All right, so what are we going to do in this workshop today? We are going to learn about how our research gives a context for what we're talking about. We're going to be identifying strategies that work in training clergy, and we're going to be increasing understanding the barriers that impact collaborations with clergy. In addition to, we're going to rethink how we approach African-American clergy in regard to implementing mental health training and how we design training that will be effective in this process, especially in Christian contexts. And lastly, we want to invite you. It's a smaller audience today. We want to invite you into a conversation when we're done with the formal part of our presentation so we can discuss what concerns you might have, what your research is, what your experience is. All right, so I'm going to start with talking about my research. It's a qualitative study I already approved. And the purpose of the study was to improve understanding of African-American clergy perspectives from their perspectives of how they address partner violence in their churches. The participants were 8 African-American clergy. That included 6 men and 2 women, 3 of whom were immigrants, and 2 of whom have experience working in the court system. The denominations represented are African Methodist Episcopal, Baptist, Full Gospel, Church of God, and that was self-identified as a Pentecostal denomination, Seventh-day Adventist, and Presbyterian. Now, the study provided data in several categories, some of which I think is very important to understanding what's going on with clergy perspectives in relation to IPV. IPV is intimate partner violence. The categories of information included their counseling process, the ways that they think about partner violence and talk about it from the pulpit, their pulpit commentary, and just church ambivalence in relation to it. Now, more specific findings include that clergy engage in clinically sound practices. This is not information that's widely known, and I think it's very important to emphasize that information today. The practices include beginning where the client is not rushing the recovery process, basic triage, which is needs assessment, and case management and advocacy. Now, what's important to know about this is that these strategies are not being implemented uniformly across the board. So you're not going to find a full range of all of these strategies being implemented by African-American clergy in all cases. And you'll find it in pockets, and that's important to know. The findings that are important to today's study are more specific to their concerns around mental health training and the ways that they were prepared to address mental health issues in their congregations. Now, I also want to add that while clergy are interested in getting mental health training, they're not interested in becoming counselors. They're not looking to replace therapists. They just want help in order to do this, and they want to build up their understanding of how to address this issue, which is a deficit area in their own training. Dr. Hamm?
Excuse me. Is there a reference that you just made that they're not interested in becoming counseling? That
comes directly from my research.
Okay. Is it published?
It is published. It is in, which, you know,
is it the
reference is there, huh?
Is it in the bibliography?
Yeah. It is in the bibliography.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. You think of it, let me know.
Journal of Religion and Spirituality.
Religion and Spirituality, yes. This is one of those days where the minute you think about it, it flies out your mind. So, and it was published in 2010.
Okay, so I'm going to continue the discussion about our research. So Dr. Dyer's talking about her research that's pertaining to this subject, and I'm going to talk about some of the studies that I've done that pertain to this particular pertain to pastors. So the first project that I did, it was a qualitative study. And what it did is examine the sermon content of 10 sermons some African-American Pentecostal pastors. And the reason why I wanted to do that is what I did is I engaged in a content analysis of audio tape sermons, and there were 10 Pentecostal pastors from California, Texas, and New Mexico. And the goal was to find out if black pastors spoke about mental health treatment in, over the pulpit, and also if they spoke about depression over the pulpit, and if so, what ways did they speak about depression? So for that particular study, some of the findings that I received from that study suggested that, at least in the African-American Pentecostal tradition, depression is a moral weakness, or depression was considered to be a moral weakness that could be countered with more active praise, or, and another thing that was that I found through that study was that saints, which are true men and women of God, don't wallow in tears, but instead they rely on Jesus. And a third thing that I found from that study was that the use of psychiatrists and psychotropic medications was frowned upon in the sermon. They said that's not the best choice, it's not the first. So that's what I found through that first study. Then I did a second study, and this was a quantitative study where I surveyed 204 pastors in California, and the sample was a random sample of pastors of Protestant Christian faith. They were heads of churches of over 26 different denominations. And the pastors that self-selected to participate in that study were either primarily Caucasian or African American due to the language capabilities of the study. It was an English-only study. The goal of the study, and it was called the Clergy Depressive Counseling Survey, was to find out how pastors define depression and how they counsel depression in their congregations. And so some of the findings that I got from that study suggested that white pastors in the study, they more readily agreed with statements that depression was a biological mood disorder. On the other hand, black pastors more readily agreed that depression was a moment of weakness in dealing with trials and tribulations. Also, there were some differences based upon denomination. So mainline Protestants, they didn't believe in the spiritual. Well, they did. They did believe in the spirit. Well, actually, they did not believe in the spiritual causes of depression. They more often believed in the biological causes of depression, mainline Protestants. On the other hand, Pentecostal and non-denominational pastors believe more in spiritual causes of depression. So the findings suggest that there are some racial, there are some denominational differences that might shape how pastors define depression. So we have to keep that in mind when we're working with pastors of different cultures. And then the third project is in progress. And although I don't have the results yet, I just wanted to briefly mention it. It's a phenomenological study. It's funded by the Templeton Foundation, and what it's going to do is we're going to examine the lived experiences of 40 pastors, 20 in Los Angeles, 20 in Chicago, to find out what their lived experiences are of counseling in the pastoral context. So we'll ask about what are their struggles, what are their strengths, what are their views of purpose and calling, and how does that fit into the piece of counseling when they do counseling? And so information from that study is going to help to discover in what ways that seminaries and other theological education has prepared them for counseling in urban settings. So based on Jacqueline's results, based on my findings, and also based on the literature, we can begin to discuss what a viable mental health training program might look like. And again, we're going to have a discussion later on today about it, and we want your input. But just based upon those three things, what we have found is that empirical articles that are about this topic usually make two assumptions. The first thing that they assume is that pastors are unequipped to handle mental health issues. So that's the literature often assumes that. Second thing that they assume is that that pastors are not responsive to the idea of being trained. So when you look at the literature across the board, the majority of it is, you know, more pessimistic or more negative. But in reality, we need to find out if pastors really do want to be trained. So one thing that we have found in our studies is that pastors definitely are willing to be trained. In my study of 204 pastors, three-fourths of the pastors surveyed said that they would be interested in further training if it was available to them. Jacqueline's qualitative study also found that pastors discussed the desire to be trained, so they do want to be trained. Also, one thing that I found in my study is that statistically, more pastors heading congregations in lower socioeconomic neighborhoods and more minority pastors were interested in training than white pastors in those in higher socioeconomic neighborhoods. So actually, 90% or 9 out of 10 pastors in the study that I did were interested in further training. So that's just important to have training programs that are available for minority pastors and these pastors that live in a lower socioeconomic neighborhood. Programs geared toward these pastors have to be tailored to their unique needs. So there's some problems right now with the present day types of training that we have out there. And when I say problems, it's fine for us. You know, it's fine for us as practitioners, it's fine for us as social workers, but we need to rethink the way that we do training for other populations, so for instance, specifically pastors. So practitioners in the mental health field, they kind of make assumptions about the ways to approach clergy for training. Usually the approach fits a medical model. You know, and so we've often been taught this medical model. And this is where the expert decides what the non-expert needs to learn. And this is where the expert is giving or passing on information to the non-expert. That in turn impacts approaches to collaboration. So that may be a problem if we approach pastors that way. Secondly, the structure of continuing education opportunities that we have, you know, how we have to go through CEU units and the way that we get trained, you know, a lot of times that type of same type of training setting has been exported to clergy without knowledge of whether that particular approach is viable or not for them. This in turn affects the way that clergy mental health training are structured. So, a viable training program should have several characteristics. First of all, it has to be flexible. It has to be flexible enough to serve the needs of the clergy at varying levels of experience and formal training. Now, one thing I found in my study is that there was a wide range, a diverse range of theological types of education and secular types of education. So you range from PhDs, with secular PhDs, you know, to all the way down to, you know, almost no secular training. You range from theological PhDs all the way down to no training. So so that particular program that anybody creates will need to be very flexible. Secondly, it needs to accommodate varying religions and cultural viewpoints. So that's a challenge, but that's something that needs to happen. Third, it needs to serve inner city and suburban and rural congregations. You know, a variety of geographical locations, so they have different needs. Next, it has to accommodate the diverse socioeconomic needs, the racial needs, the ethnic composition. And but yet, it still has to have a piece in it that it has to be unit. It needs to be able to unify clergy on some point, on common themes in order to create community. Dr. Geiger?
So then we come to what are the preferred strategies that clergy would like to see mental health organizations use, as social workers, as mental health practitioners. They would like to see us come to meetings. They want us to have short meetings because their time is a little bit intensely. recognize how busy they can be. And because of that, you want to also go to the meeting that they tend to be for. That's going to be very important. Mm-hmm. Distill the salient points of what it is you're trying to convey into understandable and accessible formats. Also make it short. Keep it into 20-minute segments. And give handouts that can be easily reproduced and slipped into the church bulletins. Very important. Because that reduces the amount of effort that the pastor and the leadership might have to put into disseminating that information. That makes it much more readily available for them to distribute. Now, one of the concerns that clergy have with the strategies that we use, one of them is not building partnerships over time. What they have found is that agencies will do outreach and coordinating efforts that are around the agency's task force ideas or that are based on crises. So we blow in, blow up, and blow out, which is kind of what we hear evangelists do, except we're not evangelizing. We're not maintaining the relationship. As a result, what they see is we come in, we kind of dictate what it is that they need to do, what the churches need to do, and then we're gone. And pastors are looking for relationships to be built over time and maintained. They're also concerned that community agencies are not communicating in a way that allows the pastors to be on the same page. They kind of talk over their heads in some ways. And when we're forming coalitions, we're forming those coalitions without necessarily including pastors and churches in the development of them. So again, if clergy are invited to existing coalitions, it's an afterthought. But in the planning process, we may not invite them as part of the process, and that's very important. All right, now, we're not going to talk about what clergy concerns are without talking about the ways that they have identified for themselves that they can complicate the issue. One of them is that the pastors may not have the same commitment to the mental health issue that you've identified. So we might come with a topic that we believe is very important and we want them to participate. And yet that particular person that you're speaking to, that leader, may not have identified that issue with the same level of urgency. And so that partnership, that effort, may not flourish. Another concern is the possibility that the leadership might have that we come with an agenda that is not going to be in the same theological lines as what is being preached for that congregation. So how do I know that what you're saying to my people is something that I can trust that will support your faith process? Mm-hmm. And also, there is the busyness in the church and the business of the church. And many of the pastors, especially those in low socioeconomic regions and communities, are doing second jobs and maybe even third jobs. So their availability is very limited as well. Very important things that can complicate it. And some of these things are not specifically designed to thwart collaborative efforts. They just are, and we've got to find ways to really think about how our approach is and how it works. All right, so now our solutions. How do we really begin to address all of these things that we've just identified? Don't stop your outreach efforts. Don't stop trying to communicate. Even if the conversations with the minister heads reveal practices that you might find not to be clinically sound, one of the things I found in my research were that pastors, and this is research again related to intimate partner violence, the partners tended to interview the couple conjointly in couples that have identified domestic violence. Now, that is not a condoned practice clinically. It's definitely not condoned in the DV field. But it comes from a place where the pastors want each partner to know that you're here for them, that we want to make sure that your concerns are heard. So it's coming from a loving place. It is not coming from a potentially destructive place, but we know of the potential clinically that it can create. Some of the response to that within the community is to stay away from people that are engaging in those kinds of practices. We can't let understanding that certain practices are not, shall we say, best clinical practices, stop our outreach efforts. Very important that in the relationship we begin the process of transformation. Learn to speak their language. We may come in without an understanding of the symbols, of the references, of even the theological perspectives. Now, we don't have to become theologians, but these are things that we can find out in conversation very easily. And we say to the pastor, we say to the leader that we're speaking to, you know, I want to collaborate with your church, but there are a number of things that I don't understand from your perspective. So maybe that's part of our exchange. I bring information that's helpful and useful to you, and you help me understand ways that can speak to your congregation and to your leaders that is viable and acceptable. And use that friendly language. Make it accessible. Address power equity issues in the collaboration. Again, this speaks to the comment that Dr. Payne had made, that we come in with a medical model. We come in as the experts. That process undermines the fact that we are talking to people who are experts in their fields. They are experts in what they've been doing forever. And I say forever, considering. If you're doing this work for more than 10 years, then you are an expert at what you have been doing. And we are approaching pastors that have been doing this work for at least that time. Younger pastors will definitely speak to the places in which they have experts. Pastors that have been doing it for 10 years or more consider themselves solidified in the field. And so their expertise needs to be acknowledged, recognized, and engaged in the process. Conversation, addressing that, and not approaching solely as experts, but as partners. Identify points of congruence and incongruence in the strategies that you are bringing to the table. There are going to be some that very clearly fit with the theological perspectives of the clergy. There are going to be some that don't. And when they don't, have conversations about that. It is not that a strategy that appears to be incongruent cannot be used. It is just that you need to make sure that you and the leadership are on the same page. And in that process, you can discuss ways that those strategies can be modified to fit the needs. And address clergy apprehensions about your intentions. Now, it may be that the initial partnership process is going very smoothly, no concerns at all. But at some point in the exchange, a strategy is identified or presented that might present a little ripple apprehension for the church leadership. When that's the case, just talk about it. Have a conversation. Keep it open and ongoing. Build relationships outside of crises, outside of targeted projects. Very important, because that allows there to be more grace for when you're trying to get a special project or a special effort done that may be coming just from your agency. And have whatever conversations you can to minimize assumptions about the training that clergy might need. So again, this speaks to the comment that Dr. Payne had made. We come in with our sense of expertise, but we don't really ask the pastors, is this the kind of training that you're looking for? This is part of the conversation we need to make. Now, these things might seem in some ways invasive, but we're not doing that.
Okay, Dr. Dyer just talked about, you know, some of the solutions, and so I'm going to talk to you about some of the structural solutions. So first of all, like I said before, the traditional educational format is not going to work. We just need to know that the way that we got taught as mental health professionals, going to a master's program, or, you know, however we got taught, those same traditional formats don't work. They're not the best fit for pastors who are financially, you know, and temporally tied to their congregation. They just don't work. And so there needs to be a conceptual framework developed that needs to be decided upon even prior to going into you know, training of these pastors. But whatever framework that we decide to use, the curriculum needs to be tailored to the faith community's paradigm. It needs to be tailored to their way of knowing and their experience. And so when we're developing a conceptual framework for our mental health training program for clergy, again, we have to back up from some of our own assumptions. We have to deconstruct our assumptions that we make as traditional clinicians. We already talked about the medical model. We didn't talk about psychological nomenclature. But, you know, we are tied to our own psychological nomenclature, and we know it, and we have a lot of acronyms that we use. Pastors have, you know, no idea about the nomenclature that we use. They, on the other hand, have a completely different language. So we need to speak on their level, in their language. Not saying that our language is better than their language, it's just a different language. When I did this study with pastors to find out how they talk about depression over the pulpit, they use words like boo-hooing. They use words like, sad. You know, they use other words besides the words that we use. And that's just a small snippet of, the language differences that we have. So we need to make sure that we're speaking their language. And then, like I said, the majority of ministers are dissatisfied with the traditional workshops. And there are some workshops out there. There are some programs out there that attempt to bring information as far as mental health to clergy. In fact, I've been, past month, been traveling to different programs to kind of see how they're set up. But, they appreciate some of that information, but at the same time, like what you said, just shooting some information at them over a weekend or shooting information on an eight-hour seminar is not going to change, the nature of what's going on in their own, communities or in their congregation. So what they're going to need is they need knowledge that directly applies to what they're going through in their own congregations. They need knowledge that's going to directly apply to the day-to-day knowledge, the problems that they face. And so another structural issue is that, travel away from the church for a lot of pastors is difficult. So the training needs to be convenient. It needs to be brought to them instead of, us having a training that that they need to come to. I went to a training, I think, just a couple of days ago, and it was a wonderful training for pastors, but it was in a suburb that was like 40 miles away, from the city, and I'm in Chicago, and even I got lost, it's like even I had a hard time finding a place. So I was thinking, well, how many pastors that don't live in this area are going to be able to travel and go to this? So we need to make sure that it's convenient. We need to bring it to them. And then ideally there should be incorporated in the design, there should be some small group discussions. There should be some integrated teaching around case material back and forth. Again, it should be practice material that pertains to what they're going through. It should be some denominational specificity involved, depending on what denomination they're from. And it may not necessarily even be denominational. It could just be sort of a general type of, group of Pentecostals or a group of, mainline Protestants or whatever, as opposed to, specific denominations. But at any rate, it needs to be specific enough to increase comfort for that pastor, so that, it won't feel completely foreign to them. It needs to be a place where they feel comfortable sharing with other pastors in that same arena. So ideally, create a sense of community amongst pastors, hopefully. A clinically oriented case format would be best. A lot of times we've learned, or I know I've learned with vignettes, or Cageman yet, you know, in order to diagnose or in order to, you know, to be able to determine signs and symptoms of mental illness. And case vignettes were, videos were, you know, things that, again, pertain to that, the individual's issues that, that they deal with every day.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Your bullet point where you said most mentors are dissatisfied with the traditional conference method of learning, can you be a little bit more specific about what you mean traditional conference form?
Sure. So there's certain types of conferences, you know. Like, for instance, this is a traditional type of conference, right? You'll have an annual convention once a year, you know, people will come for, you know, 3 days and they'll get training, you know, snippets of training. That's one type of example. And another type of example is what I was saying as far as continuing education units, like for people who are, you know, social workers and licensed clinical social workers or whatever, they need to go out and get like 36 hours of continuing education units a year. And the way that's structured is they will go to wherever, a hospital or wherever it's being held, and they will stay there for 8 hours and they will learn something about domestic violence. And then by the end of that, they get a certificate and then they go on their merry way. Doesn't work because, you know, they need ongoing training. They may need maybe, and I don't know the number yet, but maybe they need 12 weeks of training, but structured in a different way where it would be ongoing training, but again, it would be maybe partly web-based, partly where they would meet in a group. I don't know, but at any rate, they're not coming to those types of trainings. You know, when they hold those trainings, they're not coming.
And I have thought about that as well. I mean, imagine when we were learning all of this material. It was foreign language to us. So we are now presenting this material in a training to people whose field of expertise is very divergent from ours. It's going to be difficult to take it all in. And then now that I've got material that I'm not sure what it's really telling me, I've got to apply it to my situation that they need to speak to. So those are other considerations as well when we're talking about conference formats.
Yeah. And I'll give you another example. I just went to a training, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and it was, you know, these are innovative trainings. They're not very, it's hard to find these trainings where they're intersecting mental health and clergy. But this particular trainer was by a chaplain's program, the VA. And so that program was trying to teach clergy on how to deal with, you know, veterans in their communities and that type of thing, and what type of like PTSD, what types of issues that might come up in the community. And it was a great training, but again, you had to get there. And secondly, you know, they shoot the information at you, and that's it. So, you know, there's no follow-up with the pastors. There's, you know, no way of knowing that how they integrate the material. So there has to be a different way.
So when we're talking about lessons learned, basically we've got to learn how to navigate the community gate points from the perspective of the gatekeepers.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, you know, we need to expand the way we think. We need to expand our paradigm. We need to expand our own epistemologies, our own worldview as practitioners in order to reach pastors.
And with that, what we'd like to do is open up this process even more for additional questions and for conversation, because your own experiences even are very valuable to this process.
Now, as far as you know, when we're saying a discussion, we don't have all the answers. What we would love to do is know what your views are about how a mental health training program could be created that could be really viable.
I'm a Floridian who's moved to Tennessee, and I think regionally, we have different needs in different parts of the country. moving to Tennessee, there's a very relational model where I can have the ear of my pastor who has influence over other pastors to vignettes or things that have happened. Suicide in our church. But through relationship building with my pastor, he's devastated. We're all devastated, but he looks for a referral from me what to do. And it's easy for me to refer my colleagues who are experts in the field to come in to debrief the whole congregation. I see my role as not providing mental health, but in relationship, teaching him in conversation about things that I've seen in the field and how they play out in a congregation, the needs that we have. And the other thing is, he invites, not because I asked him to, but because he has learned in relationship, he takes it to the ministerial association. He provides his own conference, recharge for other pastors in the region who flood the parking lot for a day of training from other pastors, because now the pastor has shared that information to them and they are training each other.
That's right. And that's a really important comment, that as we build the relationships, we help the pastors to be able to educate their own. Because one of the things that I did really get out of my research is that pastors glean best from other pastors. It's not that they don't hear us, but there is a way in which that another pastor is able to present the material, and they know that they're talking to someone that understands their experience and their struggles intimately. And so I think it's very effective. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, another thing you mentioned that was really important is relationship and how, you know, the pastors are relational. It's wonderful to be able to use somebody in your own congregation to be able to handle some of these issues. I was the same way in my previous congregation. My pastor really called me when it was somebody suicide. My pastor was calling me when it was somebody who, who needed help or who was schizophrenic, didn't know how to handle certain issues. And it worked, because he knew in his congregation, he knew who were the people who had, psychiatry degrees or psychology degrees or whatever it was. So he utilized the people that he knew. But I guess, that's what we're trying to do, or I'm trying to struggle with, is to find out how can we as, practitioners create that relationship with pastors to where we feel, that it's a back and forth, where it's a positive relationship, because right now it's not, it's not necessarily positive. Mm-hmm.
So, for the example that you just given with your pastor contacting you in a certain way, does that impact at all the way that you meeting and preach about mental health issues?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, and like I say, there's a diversity of pastors, and everybody has different backgrounds. That particular pastor, he was very, educated. He had a PhD in Christian education, but he also, he also was a substance abuse counselor in the past. So he was pro mental health. So when he spoke over the pulpit, it would be a little different. But yeah, I think if you have those relationships, it will change what you say over the pulpit.
And I just want to speak with the lady for a second. The significance of that is in another research project that I've done. That one is not specific changes, but information we're getting from that is that what pastors are saying from the pulpit is not being heard in the pews. And one of the significances of that is that I was interviewing couples and partners living in the same house, married for long periods of time. We're talking about more than 10 years, more than 15 years, have different messages from the same house. Different messages. And I know that that comes from a place where the pastors are trying not to disclose knowledge that they've got from members of their congregation when they're preaching. But because that information is presented in a soft way, it is coming across in this without giving for people with peace to understand what they're saying specifically. So it's very important to have a relationship.
Yes, I keep the comment on that because that would depend on how invested the member is, and in marriages, it's 7-1 women and men in terms of the message, in terms of their orientation, and that depending on what cultural group we're talking about, that how they get the cultural cues of the message through the message differently, but. I don't know if this is a question or not, but one thing that came to mind was the pastors that I have studied have tended to be multicultural themselves and not realize often how they have learned how to deal with members in their community, which are of a particular cultural orientation that's different from the pastors, because many pastors are educated or well-informed or come out from a middle-class, if you, it's tough to say that, background, even if they're living in an impoverished community, because rarely do pastors go to seminary to become rich. And if there are some, I mean, maybe in those, but so there is kind of a latent skill and knowledge among pastors that they're unaware of, that they have learned how to deal with communities. And that gets to your question of training. So it seems to me that it will be important to have an element in that training that can draw from those pastors in context. It's more than just language. The faith language is also a cultural informant language that they develop intuitively or explicitly.
Let me disclose that this, I enjoyed the all's presentation and what you presented. It's something that's very dear to my heart. In fact, my dissertation was done on something very similar to this, you know, and I've also written on this subject. Now, you know, I'm also an ordained pastor, you know, and, you know, seminary training. One thing I know is that seminaries, unless a pastor goes into seminary with the idea of becoming a pastoral counselor, then the only course you're going to take in seminary is kind of like psychology 101. You know, having MSW before I went into seminary, you know, I was far ahead of many of the my fellow students. Now, you know, I started working on this back in the early 90s and became very concerned. In fact, the title of my dissertation, you know, is "What are the factors that influence African American church goers to seek help from their pastors instead of traditional social service agencies?" You know, and so, you know, and what I did was I researched just about every black denomination that there is in America, you know, to look at this, because I knew that there were going to be a wide range of theological views, a wide range of denominational views, you know, and I came across a lot of this. The thing is that you're right in that overwhelmingly pastors are not trained to provide mental health services. They're not, you know, if I hadn't had an MSW before I went to seminary, I would have been trained at it either. You know, you have to be intentional in going for that. Overwhelmingly, they believe that, or should I really say we, since I'm one of them, we believe that just by being called by God, that qualifies us to do this. You know, and I sat in meetings with them, talked to them, you know, so I know that this is the way many of us feel. Even when I'm sitting there, really saying to them, well, you know, that's not quite the case. You know, the other thing I know is that a lot of mental health does happen on Sunday morning when that pastor is preaching.
Yeah.
And if he's preaching a good sermon.
Yeah.
The truth is that a lot of the black preaching style has gotten lost over the years.
Okay.
And so, oh yeah, you know, the, and the, you know, when you look at the history of the black preaching style, you know, the black preacher tells three stories. He tells the biblical story, he tells the church story, and he or she tells their story. And so, and then they weave all three of those stories together in that sermon. A lot of it has gotten lost to the point where it's become an exercise in emotion and a lot of strain and power. You know, so the storytelling style has gotten lost. And so people are, you know, we've gotten to the point where, you know, the preacher has increased and less words jumping up and down and running up and down the aisles and stuff. You know, So I do what you're saying, and I agree with you. You know that there has to be different ways of approaching this. When I did this training, again in the 90s, when I met with a group of traditional social service agencies, and I met with a number of them throughout the state of Ohio. You know, I would say to them is, you know, one of the things you have to do is to go to these pastors and say, we need your help. Not that we have something for you, but say that, you know, we need you to help us. And for those who could understand that, the other thing, and I have to say this, you know, the one thing that I've learned about our Caucasian brothers and sisters over the years, they have this attitude, and I've dealt with a whole lot of them, you know, and I live in southern states, so let me say that too, so I've dealt with them around the country. They believe that if they can't fix the problem, nobody can fix it. If they can't fix it, nobody can fix it. So, but for those who accepted what I was telling them and saying, you know, you go to the pastor with, when you meet with the pastors, go to them with your head in your hand and say, we need you. You know, for those that did that, it turned out real well. But the problem is that for many of them is that long-lasting relationship or building that continuing relationship like you ladies were talking about. So I hear what you're saying, you know, and I like it, you know, and it's true, even with my dissertation and the study that I did, more than 80% of the church people that I questioned said that they would go to their pastor first before they would go to the traditional social service agency.
And despite the way that people's use and going to churches seems to be changing in this country, seems to be diminishing, that holds true. That's been consistent across time. And no matter how much attendance at church might be diminishing, people are still going to the pastors first. And even people from the community that don't go to church are going to pastors first. And very important. And what I think, another point that you mentioned that I just want to emphasize, I found that in my study as well, that pastors are sensitive to being disrespectful. And if we approach them in a way that feels in any way disrespectful, then that shuts down an avenue and access to many people, especially if it's a large church in the community. So very important for us to do to remain in a process that is perceived as respectful and fun.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, that's very rich. Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of work to do, definitely. I mean, we have a lot of work to do in terms of, you know, trying to figure out the best ways to keep the relationship going. I think just one thing that you mentioned that has to do with humility is that definitely we have to be humble when we're coming in, you know, working with this particular population. We need to be humble and say, put our hat in our hand and go in there and ask them for that. Knowing that they already are dealing with these issues, that we need them, you know, more than necessarily they need us. So I agree with everything you said.
And again, I'm talking about us again. We are sensitive. We are also arrogant. We're very competitive with each other. You know, so and all of those things have to be taken into account. It's a real hard job sometimes getting a number of us across the denominational line sitting in one room.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting finding of this second study I talked about, with 204 pastors. I'll say it just briefly, but like when you look at their education, pastors who had a little bit of community college but didn't have a degree, they thought they knew more than the ones who had the degree, and they thought they knew more than the ones that had nothing. So it was interesting. So kind of like what you were saying, they're going on just a little bit of information, and they're going, forth pretty quickly.
Well, again, they feel like, we feel like we've been called by God, so God will provide everything that we need.
Yeah.
Of course, we have a tendency to overlook that one scripture in John when Jesus says, I'm going to send the Comforter back to help you remember what I taught you. they don't understand that if you haven't been taught anything, then the Holy Spirit can't get anything out.
Amen.
That's the way we think. It's about the virtue of the calling. God provides us with everything we need.
But the importance of the calling, the sensitivity, the arrogance, all of those factor into the culture that is part of the community of the mm-hmm. And it's important for us to be aware of
that. Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast.